It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
A battle, a back and forth, a debate. Repartee with Shark Tanks, Kevin O'Leary. It's the Will Kane Podcast on Fox News Podcast. What's up? As always, I hope you will download, rate, and review this podcast wherever you get your audio entertainment, at Apple, Spotify, or at Fox News Podcast. Mr. Wonderful, Kevin O'Leary of Shark Tank, appeared on Fox and Friends in a 3-minute segment. And as I'm wont to do sometimes, I pick the fight. I pick the debate. Over regional banking and whether or not we should decline to bail out the mismanagement and failures of small banks while bailing out Bank of America. Should we force us into this situation where too big to fail, but if you're too small, we'll let you sink? I was excited to have Kevin O'Leary here on the Will Kane Podcast because I knew he was always up for a deeper conversation, a longer conversation, and a back and forth. It's not antagonistic. It's two people interested in a subject, and sometimes, fine, you get the truth by conflicting ideas. But it wasn't just about regional banking. I wanted to see Kevin O'Leary's thoughts on cryptocurrency. I wanted to ask him about his involvement with FTX and Sam Bankman-Fried. I wanted to talk to him about the economy at large, where he thinks it's going. And I wanted to find out, hey, what makes for a good entrepreneurial pitch on Shark Tank. Here you go. Here's our conversation today with Kevin O'Leary. Kevin O'Leary, really glad to have you on the Will Kane Podcast. Look at that nice and friendly smile. On average, when most people encounter you, would you say on a scale maybe from 1 to 10 that they are a 10 in terms of intimidation? Are they intimidated when they speak to you, Kevin O'Leary?
I think over time they understand I tell the truth. And, you know, sometimes the truth intimidates people. Sometimes they don't want to hear it. You've heard that line before. But I think it's what my mother taught me decades ago. Always tell the truth and you'll never have to remember what you said. It served me well.
Yeah, I think that my wife and I have that conversation often. I don't value, look, it's a value to be nice, but we've elevated the idea of being nice above being truthful. And as you said, sometimes the truth hurts. You're the bad guy, though, man. You're the villain on Shark Tank. You're the bad guy.
Well, I mean, sometimes you ask yourself, is it really nice to tell somebody to keep going on, keep mortgaging their home, keep doing what they're doing when you know with certainty the idea has no merit, it's bankrupt, and they're going to zero? I'd rather just say, look, this idea really sucks, and you should stop doing it because the most valuable asset you have is your time, and you're wasting it. Now, you know, I've got Lori to my left and Barbara to my right, and they always are so kumbaya. Well, I'm not going to invest in you, but you just keep doing what you're doing. You know, I hope it really works out. That is so disingenuous. I think it's criminal.
I want to talk about Shark Tank, but it actually wasn't my primary objective in this conversation today. So we'll get a few of Shark Tank's questions out now. I'm curious, you just laid it out, at least with several of your fellow co-stars, your philosophical difference. If you had to describe what makes you different from the others, from Mark, and we're talking about as an investor, but I mean, I guess that's inherently tied to you as who you are as a person. What makes you different from the others sitting on that panel of investors?
Well, the great thing about Shark Tank is everybody's self-made and they all came from different disciplines. So it's unique in the sense that we can look at any deal from any sector. You know, we have 11 sectors in the economy and somebody knows something about it because we're not your typical venture firm where you've got a bunch of juniors that have never run businesses. They have no idea what they're doing and they're just guessing at what's going to work. We're all operators. We've been there before. So my attitude is, look, my structures are always around getting my capital back because you don't make any money. You know, this idea of return on capital, that's ridiculous in venture investing. It's return of capital that matters. So that's why I like royalties, venture debt, structures where I get my capital back. And, you know, frankly, at the end of the day, these businesses, and if you look at any venture startup in America, 8 out of 10 fail, but not on Shark Tank because we have 100 million eyeballs and we get them all kinds of free customer acquisition. So it's a very powerful dynamic. And everybody's personality is different. I don't agree with the structures that Mark puts out there. He doesn't agree with mine sometimes, but that doesn't matter. I mean, we have many deals together at the end of the day. We do a lot of business together, as I do with all the sharks. We're in it to help entrepreneurs and make money. And I think there's nothing wrong with that. It's an iconic platform in America today.
You said 8 out of 10 entrepreneurial ventures fail, but you just also said it's better on Shark Tank. What is the ratio of hits on Shark Tank?
About 6 out of 10 make money, and about 4 out of 10 make a lot of money. And that's
versus 2 out of 10 you describe in the market at large, versus 2 out of 10.
I mean, if you go back to 1954, you look at the data on venture investing in America, you've got 10 deals. Look at them 5 years later. Two of them made all of your money, and then about 4 to 5 of them are just vampires of death. They made nothing. They're just still struggling along, but they're just a waste of time. And the rest went to zero in 36 months. So it's kind of, that's the nature of the business. You're not going to change it unless you have a platform like Shark Tank, where you've got 100 million people watching it each year. They see a product they like, they go online, they buy it. So the internet and online shopping and Shark Tank all happened at the same time, and it just changed the way America works.
You know, I think that's a good transition to talking a little more about the market at large. I know this is something you're passionate about, and that is that I believe you've laid out, you think it's way too hard in America right now for the small businessman.
It's really hard, because what's happened, after 18 years of free money, we had the most unprecedented rate hikes in 40 years. I mean, from zero, and then just one rate hike after another, and all of a sudden the cost of capital for small business has skyrocketed. Then you get the Silicon Valley Bank blow up, and now small regional banks are being questioned left and right. There's about 54 regional bank brands, and they have between 100 and 1,000 branches. So you've got around 4,500 banks, and basically none of them are lending any money anymore because they can't. They have upside-down balance sheets, or they're run poorly, or they're very concerned about liquidity and they can't put new loans out. So businesses that are doing under $1 billion in sales right now are really, really struggling.
You know, Kevin, let's do this. You and I began on Fox and Friends to have a very short, as is the nature of Fox and Friends, with 3-minute segments, a very short debate about whether or not we should be extending to small banks, regional banks, the same types of government support we do to the large banks. You made the argument that you got to let, and look, philosophically, I love your argument. It's, you got to let malinvestment pay. You have to have people pay the price of being bad at their job. But I am worried about this system where that's true for the small guy, but not for the big guy. I'm not an idiot, Kevin. I don't think, in that I am somewhat of a pragmatist in understanding, yeah, but we have to bail out the big guys or we all go down. But I'm worried, what does this create if the big banks get bailed out for their bad decisions? But as you have advocated, all the little small banks, they're the ones that have to live by the true free market. They have to go out of business.
I think what we should be talking about, because you're raising a good point, but now that we have time to really drill down into this, you're talking about guaranteeing depositors, okay? There's two ways to look at this. Are you going to guarantee the shareholders of a bank run by an idiot? I would argue never do that. But are you going to guarantee every single deposit is basically what happened in the Silicon Valley Bank situation. The largest depositor was Circle with $3.2 billion, which is an internet, you want to call it, crypto company that does USDC. It was completely paid back. Shareholders have been virtually wiped out, and that's okay. But when you have 4,500 banks, you know with certainty that some percentage of them are run by idiots. And so when you ask somebody in a state like Illinois or maybe in, you know, South or North Dakota, that should they back a bank run in Virginia or Tennessee, their answer is going to be, why? Why do I have to do that? I don't understand why that matters to me, because remember, these regional banks were set up to deal with the uniqueness of each economy in every state. And that made sense when there was no online banking. And much of the loan book, up to 40%, is commercial real estate. And in some states, commercial real estate is doing a lot better than others. And so when you start to guarantee and tell taxpayers, because people say, oh, FDIC is not taxpayers' money, that's complete BS. The fees that you're charged in a bank, a percentage of them create the FDIC fund, of which one failure took almost 10% of it away, $20 billion out of 200 plus billion, which is all the FDIC fund is, has been wiped out by Silicon Valley Bank. And that's just one idiot bank. Then there's Signature Bank. Then there's First Republic Bank, and on and on and on. All I'm arguing is, okay, why don't we just leave the FDIC insurance alone at $250,000 and let the market be the market over the next 2 to 3 years? And what you're going to see happen is the small idiot banks will be bought by, because you can tell they're idiot banks because you look at their balance sheet, and they were stupid enough to buy 30-year treasury bonds thinking rates would never go up again. Only an idiot would do that. Certainly not a banker. So why would you want an idiot banker running a bank like that? And there's many idiot bankers because they've never lived through a period like this. The only thing you care about in banking is duration and quality in the loan book and on what you buy with customers' deposits. So all the idiots should be scraped away, and all the shareholders of the idiot banks should be wiped out. And the depositors are left with their $250,000 guarantee. And the reason I bring this up and the final thought here is the market will consolidate to super regionals. We don't need 4,500 now that you have online banking. We need maybe 800. All of Britain is run by 300 banks. All of Canada by six. There's a handful of banks in Australia. Those economies already went through this. You don't need to support thousands of tiny banks. There's no need for them anymore, particularly the idiot banks.
So your prediction then, were we to let the market play this out, is over the next couple of years, we consolidate from all of these banks into some super regionals. So we're left with what kind of banking market? I mean, we're going to have the what? 5 to 10 gigantic banks, the Bank of America's, the Citibanks, but then we'll still have super regionals, the winners of this regional fallout?
It's happening as we speak. The problem these banks have, all of them, is it's really hard to get anybody to put their money in there after what they've realized happened. That's not good. The muscle memory on that's going to stay around for a long time. I've already taken all of our money out of regional banks in any investment we have in over 50 companies, and we've opened up accounts in the large money center banks. We are never putting capital back to work in any regional bank. Not now, not ever.
Okay.
Now, because we're dealing in amounts way more than $250,000, so I can't take a chance. I don't know if it's an idiot banker or not. What am I supposed to do? Look at the balance sheet of every bank? That's too much work.
Right, to the extent that you could even get access to every single one of them. I'm going to be upfront with you and the audience. Like, I have an emotional attachment to the concept of regional banks. I'm from a small town in Texas. I know the role that small regional banks have played in my entrepreneurial career. I was in newspapers, Kevin. I don't expect you to know that, meaning I owned small regional newspapers at a time when it was still a viable thing to own small regional newspapers. Just deep family connections to regional banks. So, like, I have emotional investments in one side of this debate, but there's this side as well. It's not like small regional banks are the only idiots in banking. And just because you're at Bank of America doesn't mean you're a genius. And so, you know, they're not the only ones that bought long-term treasuries, you know, or too many long-term treasuries. And the more we consolidate and the more we protect certain idiots, I look at a system beyond simply the banking system, but the political system, where if you're down to a fractionalized but gigantic banking system, fractionalized meaning only a few, but there are a few that there are, is they're gigantic, they're manipulatable. Politically, they're manipulatable. They are now going to make idiotic decisions because they're making decisions based upon idiot politicians, Kevin. They're going to do whatever is incentivized out of Washington, D.C., and I don't know. That's the next thing that comes down the pike, where we have three or four banks telling us, we're not going to bank you if you're into guns, or we're not going to bank you if you have a bad carbon footprint, or whatever it may be. They are beholden to the politicians that continue to bail out their idiocy.
Well, let's answer the two questions you've raised there. Let's go back to the Kumbaya small regional bank, where your hometown, where you grew up back 100 years ago. Maybe that bank was established.
Not that old.
Well, you know, I'm saying when it got established because of the regional nature of that economy, and you rode your horse up to the bank, you knew the bank manager, you took a loan out, you expanded your ranch, your homestead, whatever, and then you rode your bicycle in the 50s. And look, I love Kumbaya, but then I ask you, Would you put your entire net worth into that bank today? Would you personally take a risk bigger than $250,000? You don't have to answer me because the answer is no. And so if you really cared, you take a lot of risk, and you're not going to do that. You're not going to put your family at risk because you don't know if this manager is going to be, you know, superseded by the next manager who could be an idiot manager and wipe you out personally. You don't want that to happen. And so I'm sorry, money's different than any other asset. People have a strange relationship with it. They don't want to take any risk with their savings account. Not 1%, not 0.5%. And that's why that regional bank that you have all those fond memories of is at real risk. And I'm sorry, this is my job to tell you the truth. I'm the guy that fights off kumbaya for you and makes you a realist. Now, regarding the super banks, banking is the 11th sector of the economy. Okay? It's one of the 11 sectors. It's unique in that it supports all other 10, and it's heavily regulated. So at the end of the day, if you're going to be guaranteeing deposits, it might as well be in behemoth banks. You're not guaranteeing shareholders. Remember all those poor bozos at Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers? They got wiped out of their equity. That's okay, and the system survived it. It doesn't matter if Lehman goes out of business. It doesn't matter if Bear Stearns goes out of business. It doesn't matter if First Republic goes out of business. The American economy is too big to care. It just rolls over those mistakes and it moves on. But banking's regulated, so think of it as a regulated utility. And lastly, this is why I'm never investing in the equity of a bank. Why would you? How are these poor schmoes going to make money given how tough it's going to be in the years ahead in terms of how tight the regulations are going to be? This is not a sector where you're going to get a high return. You might as well just use their products, buy a CD, buy a T-bill, sit back and make the government returns where you take no risk unless you don't believe in America, and then leave banks to what they do best. Loan money, but don't invest in them.
Do you believe in America? Do you believe, and I'm not asking you that. Hold on. I'm not asking you that in a kumbaya way. What I'm asking you about is what you just said. Money is the one thing that has no emotional attachment. Do you believe in the dollar, an American currency, as the both should and will remain the world's reserve currency?
Yes, 100%. You know, I love this question. It's being every week I get called by somebody saying, what do you think Russia's doing with China, with Brazil? And I say to them, how much of the money you're a fiduciary of are you putting into any of those economies or any of their currencies? Would you even own a single Chinese yuan? Would you even bother with that? Would you ever manage money and take other people's money and invest it in a Chinese currency? The answer is never. And so you think about the reserve currency of the earth. Every commodity trades to the U.S. dollar price. So my largest asset is U.S. dollar denominated. So the stocks, the bonds, the real estate I own, in America, I trust because it's a democracy that has its incredible power across so many large sectors of the economy that everybody else on earth, no matter how much they point at it and say, look at all the faults America has, ask them where they put their money.
Okay.
And the answer is always the U.S. dollar.
So the argument that I've heard and that I find holds merit is the following. The belief in the U.S. dollar is the belief in both the U.S. rule of law and the custodial responsibility of the Federal Reserve. Those two things, as long as they continue to maintain trust, is what underlies the U.S. dollar. There's nothing more anymore. It's the United States military, I guess. It's the concept of the United States of America. And of course, to your point, no, I'm not going to replace that with China or with Russia. Because if we're grading on a curve, we're still the best when it comes to those things of rule of law and civilizational foundation. But the argument that's been made is we've eroded that. The Federal Reserve has eroded that trust. They continue to print money over and over and over and over and to devalue the dollar. The rule of law in America is not something that is as strong as it once was. And if that's the case, the argument is less that, okay, well, the world moves its currencies to the yuan or the ruble, but it just begins to fracture up. And where once we dominated, you know, as being the currency of trade, maybe now it's instead of, you know, I don't know what the numbers are, Kevin, you will. Instead of 90% of trade, it goes down to 60%. And some of it's done over here and the BRICS do their thing best that they can or whatever it may be. Or maybe crypto. I'm curious about what you think of crypto. But that would be the argument that I've heard is like, quit trying to make it the dollar versus X. It's the dollar versus X, Y, Z, and 1, 2, 3, all taking little bites out of the belief in the United States of America.
It's a great argument, and you're making very valid points. The same points that were made back in 1975 about the U.S. dollar. But here's what it boils down to. The dollar itself is a piece of paper. It's built on trust. Any currency from any sovereign is their trust that you have in their nation and their ability to maintain their GDP growth, even an oil-rich nation in the Middle East. But when you ask, let's say you're a sovereign in the Middle East and you're making $260 million every 12 hours. I know the country that does that, all right? I work a lot in the Middle East. Where do they put it? Where does it go every day? It goes to New York into the S&P 500 by 10:05 in the morning. Into the American economy, the only market on earth that can absorb that much money and not even move the needle. Why? Because they trust it. And they have lots of alternatives. They could trust the Chinese with their supreme leader. Could they invest it in Venezuela? How about Cuba? How about France, where they go on strike every weekend? The only other country that even comes close to the trust the American economy has across the world, even its enemies would rather have U.S. dollars, is Switzerland and the Swiss franc. The economy is not large enough to absorb that much capital. Plus, they don't want it because they've been under such scrutiny. So, you know, whether you're Russian or whether you're Chinese, you have a hard time opening an account in Switzerland anymore. Everywhere else is secondary. And this is not because I'm kumbaya, I'm the U.S. I watch money flows every day. Billions and billions of dollars. The U.S. is a giant black hole. It sucks up all the free cash because simply nowhere else to put it that you trust.
Yeah, the analogies are just sitting there for us to pick off the tree so easily. Like, at some point, has that trust been abused? Will it be abused? Like, if it's as obvious in default as you describe it, and I know that it is, I know you're describing reality, it enables bad behavior at some point. Like, if you have that kind of trust, well, let's print some more money. Where are they going to go? They're going to go to China? They're going to go to Brazil? No. Those that can will.
I hear you, but I've been listening to this argument since 19. Yeah, I get it. But, you know, this is not a perfect country, but compared to what is the question? Because you have that option. If you're actually managing capital, as I do, every day you have to make decisions. I have to put money to work every day. Give me a better market. Where should I go? I don't mind
That's
allocating. I can allocate. I allocate 5% to crypto. I allocate 5% to gold. I allocate 20% to Europe. But where's the bulk of it? It's sitting in the S&P 500, the world's largest companies, which, by the way, have almost half their sales all around the world, governed by American law and accounting. Why are we kicking the Chinese companies off the American exchanges? Because they don't want to play by the rules. I can't safely buy their equity because I don't know if their statements are real. That's why there's no trust.
We're going to step aside here for a moment. Stay tuned.
Pull up a chair and join me, Rachel Campos Duffy.
And me, former U.S. Congressman Sean Duffy, as we share our perspective on the discussions happening at kitchen tables across America.
Download From the Kitchen Table, the Duffys, at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you download podcasts.
Yeah, that's a great, and I love the way you just did it. What you said is, okay, Will, you said great on a curve. It is graded on a curve because the money has to go somewhere. And really, the competition is not for America to be the best version of itself, which is what we would hope, is to be better than everybody else. That's how you maintain the trust. But to that point, you brought up crypto. What is your thought on it? I mean, trust is what we're talking about, right? And so trust is what underlies every currency. Is there any trust in crypto?
No. What's happened, when you think about the waves of investment, let me walk you through the last 36 months, which I find so intriguing. 36 months ago, there was nothing hotter than the crypto sector. The optimism that somehow there'd be the first U.S. regulated exchange and that crypto would be found in an ETF, notably Bitcoin and Ethereum, and then others would come along. If you'd asked the average investor or institutional investor, they would have said there's an 80% probability of that happening. Never happened. Then along came the metaverse. Billions were invested in that, notably by Facebook, cratered its stock down 70%. Then that passed. Now it's AI. Crypto is now gone into a battle between regulators and optimists in the market. There's no institutional interest in crypto until the SEC regulates it. Now, that's any speculative asset, whether it be Bitcoin on down, where there's a lot of interest, particularly in Washington, and any activity right now is spent on this, is defining the digital U.S. dollar as a payment system. So, you know, basically stable coins backed by U.S. dollars. There's still interest there to find a middle ground. But you just look at what's going on, Binance being litigated into the Stone Age, litigation with Coinbase. I moved all my assets to a country up north in Canada where they have regulation. Highly regulated broker-dealers attached to crypto exchanges. That's where I hold all my assets. But it's only 5% of our portfolios. Now, I treat it like gold. I think we're nowhere on crypto. And there's a lot of people saying, oh, yeah, don't worry. It's just not going to happen. There's no institutional allocation for Bitcoin until it gets regulated.
You know, Kevin, I don't know you. We've spoken a few times on television. I'll tell you that one of the things that I like about you is you certainly seem to have thick skin. And certainly the image that I have formed of you is someone that whose feet are firmly on the ground, who's interested in describing reality and who's not worried about being nice, but is interested in making sure he is firmly standing in the truth. What the hell with FTX, Kevin? Like, how did you buy in to FTX?
So let me talk about FTX in the context of what happened. As you say, let's just roll out the truth. In venture investing, and by the way, FTX was just a startup, okay? We talked about the stats earlier. 8 out of 10 fail. FTX was a large startup. It was 24 months old. At that point in time, FTX was considered the golden child that was going to get the ticket as a regulated exchange in America. Sam Bankman-Fried's parents were compliance lawyers at Stanford. He himself spent over 50% of his time on the Hill in Washington for the last 2 years. He met with every senator, congressman, and woman that would listen to him. The market watched that happen. And when he went to market to raise capital, every institution you know bought into that deal. It was a huge oversubscribed issue. Now, when I was approached to be a spokesperson, I looked at it and said, okay, let's look at who's on the cap table here. It was the who's who of private equity and venture investment, the largest firms on earth. That gives you some confidence. Now, you can't detect fraud every time if it's alleged fraud at this point. We'll wait and see what happens at trial. And then when I was approached to be a paid spokesperson, I never, ever support a product that I don't own as a shareholder and I don't use personally. So I told the firm, yeah, that's interesting. And I'm definitely interested in crypto. And I look at who's on your cap table and I do business with many of them. And I'm interested, but I need to own a piece of the company. I need to own a piece of FTX US and I need to own a piece of FTX International. And they said, that's impossible. The rounds are closed. They were 20 times oversubscribed. I said, I can't do the deal. I can't do it. Sorry, can't help you. They came back saying, look, some of the shareholders are willing to give some up. We're going to reallocate. You're going to get your buy-ins. You're going to have to write a check at the same price they paid. And I did. In addition, I took all of the proceeds that I was given to be paid as a spokesperson and put them into crypto in FTX wallets. When FTX went to zero, I got wiped out, both in the equity and in all of my wallets. All disappeared. And so, you know, I look at it and say to myself, does that change the way I'll work tomorrow morning? No. Do I like losing $18 million? No. But it doesn't change what I do as a venture capitalist because I know I will make bad investments again.
Okay.
Luckily, I make more good ones than bad ones.
I appreciate you addressing that head on. I actually want to follow up on what you said. Does that change the way I invest tomorrow? I don't even know how I'm going to form this question. I'm just going to talk. And then you're going to talk afterwards and you see what your reaction is. One of the ways in which you describe the way that you were pulled in to FTX was an appeal to authority. And there's nothing wrong with an appeal to authority. We always, all the time, all of us outsource some credibility. I'm not suggesting you didn't do your due diligence afterwards, but the fact that all these big people are bought in, we all would agree, oh, that lends some semblance of credibility, right? There's something going on, Kevin, where I'm worried about institutional credibility, okay? I'm worried about the idea, and this takes us where we started the conversation, a few big banks. I'm worried about, you doing a very rational thing and saying, look at all these people who are saying this is legit and this is good, right? Because increasingly, I see all of these institutions and I see that some, not all the time, but often, there's something else at play other than just fiduciary responsibility, Kevin. I think it's undeniable. I think I can look at Anheuser-Busch. I can look at Nike. I don't care. I can look at a ton of them. I can look at federal government institutions and departments and say, who's pursuing their given stated mission and who's pursuing another agenda? And it makes me very skeptical, Kevin. It makes me skeptical on the appeal to authority, not for you, for any of us going forward. And it also makes me skeptical about consolidating into a few banks. It makes me skeptical about a digital currency backed by the Fed. How is all this going to be used, and what is the baked in agenda other than what should be on the surface, your stated agenda or your fiduciary responsibility?
I like your skepticism. It's healthy. It's the underlying underpinning of a capitalist market, because the American economy is built on the most important fundamental there is in investing: choice. You make your own decision. If you have concerns, as you've raised there, that guides you in one direction. If you're pursuing a different agenda, that takes you in another. But at the end of the day, people are making individual decisions every second, every hour, every day, every
month, every year. As long as we have choice. As long as we're capable of having choice.
And I'm telling you, as long as there's choice in America, which is a fundamental freedom that is debated every single day, we're going to have lots of debates. We're going to have them because we're able to have them. And we believe in free speech, no matter how painful it is. And I've told people this so many times. The cost of free speech is the 2.5% lunatic fringe that you really don't want to accommodate, but you know deep down you have to. That's the way I look at it. So if you don't like what someone's saying, suck it up. They have that right to do it, and so do you. And that's the whole point. But, you know, people argue me, going back to the idea of consolidating banks.
Right.
I can't. This debate we've been having now for almost 6 weeks is a healthy debate. I'm just saying, let the market be the market. And then everybody says to me, oh, we have to have lots of small banks because look at what happened during the PPP loans. The only reason we were successful rolling those out was all the regional banks. That simply isn't true. The PPP loans were done all online because no one could leave the bank, their home and go to a, or their business and go to a branch. And it was all done online. You could still do all the PPP loans, and the majority were done with big money center banks.
And I don't know how much you want to brag.
And now the same things.
Yeah, and I don't know who wants to brag. I don't know how much you should brag about, not you, the proverbial you, brag about the PPP loan rollout. I mean, that's a story.
Well, it's a story, but now we have another rollout happening right now. The banks are not involved. The employee retention credit, which is going to expire in 24 months, that's not done by the banking system. There's nothing, your bank can't help you. You as a business have to file for it. And right now, it is the best cost of capital there is for small business, and nobody knows about it. I'm segueing into it because all of my companies, I've been working 25 hours a day trying to figure this 170-page program out for my companies. And I think I've done a pretty good job. I set up a huge infrastructure so they could go get the expertise to go apply for it. It's worth $26,000 per employee if you had them on W-2s in 20 and 2021. Just go to wondertrust.com and learn all about it. And please apply for your money. It's your money. It was already spent by the government. This is not new money. It's already gone.
We're going to step aside here for a moment. Stay tuned.
Do you think that's a story? The PPP loans? I mean, all my buddies, almost all of my friends where I grew up in Texas are all small business owners or entrepreneurs, or they're in finance, and they say the amount of fraud is it's shocking that we haven't talked about the fraud involved in the whole program.
It's true. It was done so quickly, and there, you know, remember, the government and the Fed and everybody at the same time is trying to say, what do we do with the collapsing economy? It was the best medicine at the time. However, I am a believer in the legal system, the tort system, the whole, you know, people are very cynical about lawyers, but you will see over the years ahead, the large frauds in PPP, if you're one of them out there, they're coming for you. That's going to happen. It, you know, that we've got to remember something about the IRS. It has unlimited resources. It's slow as a turtle, but unlimited resources. And so if you stole from the government on a PPP loan, if you're listening to this right now, I would get up, go give it back. Just go give it back, because they will one day find you. They'll start with the bigger ones and they'll get right down to the smaller ones. You just can't do that. And I swear to you, the great thing about the PPP is it's all paperwork. They have your statements. They know who you are and they know where you came from.
All right. I want to go back to Shark Tank, if we could, here before we wind this up. Setting aside the substance of a pitch, what the business is and so forth, there's also the personality and style of a pitch, right? Like somebody comes out, how they approach you, what works and what doesn't.
If you have the ability to present your idea and the merit of it, just the idea in 90 seconds or less, that's probably the most important thing you could ever do on Shark Tank. Point out you have a great idea, then spend the next 5 minutes explaining why you are the right person to execute it, because great ideas are a dime a dozen. Executional skills, you can't find them. So if all of a sudden you put the first two together, all of a sudden you've got a really interesting opportunity. You can see the investors there starting to say, wait a second, great idea. Someone explained to me why they can actually execute it. They have the experience. And lastly, and this is the killer, if you get the first two right and you don't know your numbers, you deserve to burn in hell and I'll personally put you there. So you got to get those three things right. If you get those right, you'll probably get funded on Shark Tank. That's how it works.
All right. Kevin O'Leary, I love the conversation. I appreciate the back and forth. Thank you so much.
Take care, my friend.
There you go. Hope you enjoyed that conversation with Kevin O'Leary. And if you did, please leave this podcast a 5-star review. I'll see you again next time. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts and Amazon Prime members. You can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and 4-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.